This is IRIB.
A colleague of a Palestinian journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, tells Press TV that Israeli forces deliberately killed her to silence journalists that report the regime's crimes. Another Palestinian teenager is fatally shot by Israeli regime forces during intense clashes with Israeli settlers near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. And another deadly shooting in the U.S. leaves 14 children and a teacher dead at an elementary school in Texas. Hello everyone and thanks for tuning in to World News. Now over a week into the tragic death of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, Israel refuses to accept responsibility for the killing. Another Palestinian reporter who was next to Abu Akleh when she was shot says that the regime deliberately targeted her to silence journalists. In an interview with Press TV, Shatta Hanesha dismissed claims by Israel that the veteran Al Jazeera journalist may have been hit by Palestinian fire. Hanesha says Israeli troops killed Abu Akleh to stop media coverage of the regime's crimes. Hanesha says since Israel seeks to evade accountability, it will not allow an independent probe into Abu Akleh's killing. She said it is a regular thing with Israeli forces to kill Palestinians and get away with it as no one bothers to hold them to account. Abu Akleh was killed while covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. She is widely believed to be killed by Israeli forces. The Associated Press said Tuesday its own investigation supports the assertion that the bullet that killed her came from an Israeli gun. But the regime says its own investigation has not determined that. Israel says even if that is not the case, it does not appear the soldier who fired the gun will stand guilty of criminal misconduct. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN has deplored Israel's assassination of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Zahra Ershadi said reporters' killing was part of Israel's long-standing and well-documented war of harassment, intimidation, and violence against journalists. The Iranian diplomat said the regime targets journalists to cover up its crimes committed against Palestinians. Ershadi described Abu Akleh as another victim of the international community's inaction in the face of continuous Israeli atrocities. She called on the UN and the Security Council to take urgent action to end Israel's impunity and ensure protection for Palestinians. Abu Akleh was fatally shot while covering an Israeli raid on Jenin back on May 11th. Iran's foreign minister says the country will use all its legal and international capacities to prosecute those involved in the assassination of IRGC member in Tehran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a message to the family of Colonel Hassan Sayed Khodai, who was assassinated on Sunday. He said the assassination proves Iran is in the forefront of the fight against terrorism. Amir Abdullahian said Iran has also been a regular victim of state terrorism. The foreign minister censored the silence of certain countries that claim to be fighting terror and advocating human rights. IRGC's top commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has vowed Iran's response will be tough and make the enemies regret the heinous crime. And earlier we reached out to political commentator Mustafa Khoshchesh to get his take on the matter.
Well, definitely this is going to be responded. Some people might think that how about previous operations? Iran has always vowed to take revenge. And they might have questions if this has happened ever. Well, Iran and Iranian officials, especially the top military, are not in the habit of acknowledging responsibility for operations. And when you hear the Israelis claim responsibility, it's not their officials, but it's their media in order to escape responsibility, because this is a clear case of assassination and terror, and it should be condemned. I mean, the Israelis should be condemned for that. And when the UN fails, other countries fail to condemn and punish Israel, then according to the international rules and regulations, Iran has every right to take retaliation.
Another Palestinian youth has been killed by Israeli regime troops following intense clashes with Israeli settlers near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian media said 16-year-old Gaith Rafiq Yamin was shot in the head after hundreds of settlers stormed the tomb of Prophet Joseph near the city. Violent clashes then erupted between Palestinian youth and Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Red Crescent says over 75 people have been injured. A resistance group based in the West Bank city of Jenin says its forces have shot and injured a number of Israeli troops who accompanied the settlers. Hamas has also issued a statement blaming Israel for the escalation of tensions in the West Bank. The United States has just seen one of its deadliest school shootings in years. A gunman has killed 18 children and two adults at an elementary school in the state of Texas. Suspect has been identified as an 18-year-old man. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says suspect is also dead, apparently killed by police in the town of Uvalde. Reports say a gunman drove up to the school and entered it with a rifle and handgun. The carnage follows a series of mass shootings in America this month. Despite recurring mass casualty shootings, multiple initiatives to reform gun laws have failed in Congress, leaving states and local councils have to enact their own restrictions. A new report by the FBI revealed that the U.S. experienced 61 active shooter incidents in 2021, showing a sharp rise over 2020 and the highest tally in more than 20 years. The UK is witnessing yet another wave of price hikes, one of the worst in decades. In our news review program, we explore the reasons behind the soaring cost of living in Britain. Let's have a listen.
Now, Britain's facing another jump in their power and energy bills, deepening the worst cost of living crisis that the UK has seen since the 1950s. The Office of Energy Regulation, the UK, warning of a 40% surge in household energy bills in October. Ofgem chief calling the price rise a, quote, once-in-a-generation event not seen since the oil crisis in the 1970s. He says the number of people in fuel poverty may double to 12 million. A household is in fuel poverty when it has to spend 10% or more of its disposable income on energy. The opposition Labour Party says this will cause enormous worry for families already facing soaring bills. Conditions of the global gas market have worsened since Russia launched a war on Ukraine and the West targeted the Russian energy sector with sanctions. Okay, that's the story. Now, we're going to get some insight on this. So joining me will be a couple of guests, our own Robert Carter in our London Bureau. Also joining us will be Fra Hughes, a journalist and author, as well as an activist in Belfast. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Robert, the situation, as far as I remember, we've been talking together in the past months, even before this Ukraine war started, we were talking about, economic issues and energy prices rising in the UK, right? And now on top of that, we have this Ukraine thing that is also being blamed. Tell us how terrible the situation is, and when you talk to people in the street, how do they feel about this? What's the situation really like on the ground?
Well, I think a lot of people are pretty depressed about what's going on because a lot of people were already living close to that line of, covering their monthly expenses, covering their bills, paying their mortgage and so on before the conflict in Ukraine began. And now with cost of living prices soaring and with more increases in costs expected to take place this October and going forward, many people are very frightened, very nervous, and a lot of people just do not know where that additional money to pay for their energy expenses and their daily expenses is going to come from. People are still earning the same amount of money unless they're very lucky in getting some kind of pay rise from their employer. But overall, wages have not been increased to a significant amount that people feel comfortable that they're going to be able to handle this new influx of high cost of living. So obviously, people, I think, eventually are going to start to realize that, hang on a minute, maybe this is less to do with Russia being the guys to blame for why prices are so high here. Maybe we should start looking at the politicians here in Westminster, in the White House, for example. It's their foreign policy decisions which are ultimately going to have a backlash on how the economy here and how the global economy is playing out. And I think a lot of people are starting to wonder whether it's worth paying the price when it comes to, you know, the quality of living for them and their families for what, NATO expansionism in Eastern Europe, things like that. I think it's very interesting also that the decision for Sweden to join NATO, for example, wasn't put to a referendum. That kind of thing, I think, is on a lot of people's minds, and it will continue to grow as people continue to struggle.
Yeah, Fra, on that note, let me ask you about what has caused and what has culminated into the situation in the UK. Well, we know that COVID has wreaked havoc across the world. UK is not an exception either. But we know about Brexit and also, you know, this Ukraine thing also on top of that. So let our viewers know, let's explore the factors that have led to this situation and soaring energy price in the UK.
Very good. Yes, I would agree with that analysis, and that these prices were already rising as a result of the pandemic. What we had were people staying at home, factories not needing energy supplies, no vehicles on the road, so fuel wasn't in demand. So demand fell substantially in Europe during the lockdown, which was practically for like almost 12 months on and off. Then when we came through the pandemic, you've seen a surge in demand for energy, which in itself was difficult for the suppliers to meet because everyone had kind of cranked down their processes. And this in itself led to an increase in prices. Last August, I believe, prices went up by 12% in 2021. And then you have, we suffer here in the first world countries of Europe from neoliberal austerity policies that are followed by our political elite. This isn't an economic necessity. This is a political choice. And what we are witnessing now is also not an economic necessity with the rise of energy costs. This is a political choice which is being exacted upon the most poor and the most vulnerable and the most marginalized people, the people who earn the least money, the people who can least afford these energy crises, so that the rapacious greed of the capitalists in the first world countries of the West and NATO can balkanize Russia, which is their long-term aim, and to corral the Eurasian economy, which in many respects, led by China, helped by Russia and the Global South, actually to create a sustainable economic global model for everyone in the world.
Okay, Robert Carter in London, Fra Hughes in Belfast, thank you so much for your contribution and input.
North Korea test fires three ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast just days after a visit to South Korea by U.S. President Joe Biden. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said launch was carried out in a span of less than an hour from the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. This marks the latest in a blitz of weapons tests by the North this year. South Korea and the U.S. have agreed to scale up joint military drills as well as deployment of American weapons. President Biden and his new South Korean counterpart have agreed to deploy more U.S. strategic assets if necessary amid North Korean weapons tests. The European Union remains split on imposing an oil embargo on Russia, with Hungary signaling that it will not back the proposal. In a letter to EU chief Charles Michel, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said it appears unlikely that a comprehensive solution could be found before a special meeting of the EU held later this month. Diplomatic sources say sanctions on Russian oil will be on the agenda at this summit. The Hungarian Prime Minister says banning Russia's oil will only deepen internal divisions and offer no realistic solution. Hungary has already imposed a new state of emergency, citing the war in Ukraine. European Union calls for talks with Russia on possibilities of reviving the exports of wheat and other food supplies from Ukraine.
I think this is a very complex topic, we also need in some way some dialogue with Russia on that one. It cannot be in Russia's interest that because of Russia, people are dying of hunger in the world. And therefore, I think we should first of all look at the dialogue with Russia, whether there is not an agreement that this wheat gets out of Ukraine.
European Commission President stressed that food supplies from Ukraine are necessary to prevent a global food crisis. Kiev says Russia has blockaded all of its ports, a claim Moscow has rejected. On Monday, the Kremlin blamed Ukraine for making its own commercial shipping impossible by placing mines throughout the water throughout the Black Sea coast. Ukraine is one of the top wheat producers on the planet. Kiev says its exports have fallen sharply since Russia's offensive started on the 24th of February. War and the West anti-Russia measures have pushed up prices of food commodities in many countries. The Yemeni army says it shot down a Saudi drone over the capital, Sana'a. It says the incident is the latest violation of a UN brokered truce, which is to expire next week. And now there are efforts to try to extend it. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has your details from Sana'a.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Rawayshan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdusalam, says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by a notorious organization, SAVAK. As you know, we tried to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the Imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the Imam's immediate liberation. The regime security and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Peshwa near Varamin in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini. And death to the Shah. Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the imam's house. The imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, the sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead, had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, but at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm. Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, on June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them. Lady Saghafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son, Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance. She continues, near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, are you scared? They said, we have heard so. I said, it is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity, but not escape. I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry. So I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Eshraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I hope you're doing good. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, sister. We discussed about the responsibilities of parents towards their children. You said the most important responsibilities are giving a good name, giving a better education. As you rightly mentioned, Imam Ali alayhi salam also says that education not only means the secular education, teach your children Quran. So we also said being friends with your children. And regarding that, we had an audience question that I would like to read over here for you. I am 18-year-old boy, and my parents often compare me with other people in society who qualify some state-level exams. This comparison breaks me down inside. I feel like I'm not able to even explore my talent this way. How can I make my parents understand my situation? Is there any way out for my problem in Islam? This is a very beautiful question. It's from the youth itself who is saying that, who is trying to be friends with his parents, but now he's trying to find out a way. So how can we guide actually youth to be friends with their parents?
Beautiful. I think most of our society is suffering from this disease of comparing each other, and I don't know, the way we are not satisfied with, you know, our children's status. Allah tabaraka ta'ala has given to me, for example, two boys or three girls or whatever they do, I have to be, you know, joyful with them, and I have to be thankful to Allah. But sometimes our parents, unfortunately, they are comparing a lot, especially when it comes to education, yeah, and to marking high and to some achievements. So that means, unfortunately, they don't have Allah practically in their life. They want to live for society.
All right.
Yeah, they are constantly in the pressure of societies and norms and customs. So Allah wants us to live a free life, beautiful life, you know, with just enjoy. The way our Prophet, he said, just kiss, aksiru min qublati awladikum. Frequently kiss, hug, and smell your child and enjoy, you know.
Right.
So ulama, the way, you know, some scholars, they say very beautifully that, you know, all this halal, not only halal, also, it's our mustahab, recommended stuff. If you do, which are joyful, you are just elevating your daraja towards Allah tabarak wa ta'ala. So that is our choice. Unfortunately, that because of lack of connection to Allah tabarak wa ta'ala, we are putting that pressure on our teenagers and children. Yeah. So I would say that I think we have to, first of all, we have to know that where we are and min ain fi ain ila ain, you know, why we are in this dunya. I'm here to fulfill my duties according to my capacity. That's it.
All right.
And Allah is not going to ask me and compare me with someone. So how come my parents are comparing me with someone, you know?
All right.
So that is something very unfair and injustice.
All right.
Yeah.
So you said that the problem that lies is the comparison when society, when parents start comparing their kids with others,
yeah,
who are some doing something good at the society level. Well, you said that comparison is not good because that makes them ignorant about the blessings that Allah has given to them or to their kids. Sister Najafi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Avoid reprimanding constantly, for this act provokes the committing of sin and belittles a real reprimanding."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Sister Najafi, we are talking about the responsibilities that parents have towards their kids in Islam. Is there any more responsibility? Like, do you think marriage is one of the responsibilities that parents have in Islam towards their children?
Yeah, I love chapter Noor. And chapter Noor, although whole the book of Allah tabarak wa ta'ala is Noor and light, but chapter Noor is especially
literally Noor.
Yeah, as you know, giving us beautiful Noorani and full of light and dressing and haya, iffat, modesty, chastity. So when it comes to nikah, to marriage, the way Allah tabarak wa ta'ala talks, that Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَأَنْكِحُ الْأَيَامَ مِنْكُمْ. I love it the way Allah says أَنْكِح. أَنْكِح يعني you know, mm-hmm. you, this is your responsibility. So not only parents, أَنْكِحُ means everyone is responsible.
All right.
Yeah. So if I see someone is in late teens or early 20s or mid 20s, you know, whenever, and this is the beauty of Islam. Islam never ever fixed a
particular
age. Number. Yeah, it depends. You know, sometimes I'm so much focused in my studies. I want to do
sometimes
after 2 years.
Sometimes I'm 20 exactly. And I'm not mature enough.
Yeah. So everyone has a choice. This is a beauty. You know, wow. I love the way Islam is just, you know, giving us so much room to think, to progress. So then, ankihu, if you feel, oh, someone really, you know, needs a partner, so you have to put that step, you know, and you will get for each step, each word, each click, each, you know, whatever you do for making that two partners, yeah, together for that marriage, you will get absolutely a, you know, enormous sawab near Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. But when it comes to parents, no one can, you know, deny that definitely, you know, parents' duty and their responsibility.
It's a kind of obligatory thing with them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we are not ignoring the society and friends and other relatives too. So, yeah, unfortunately, again, many cases comes to us that, and they say that, you know, I really want to get married, but my parents are looking for, again, some customs, you know?
All right.
Yeah, the customs, the norms, again, the society's pressure, you know? Oh, yeah. They live in their imaginary, rosy world that, oh, I want my girl to wear this and to have that much gold and, you know, that kind of big hall they wanna rent. And nowadays, it's not, you know, cheap at all.
Yeah. So that sounds really interesting. I'll be talking to you on that note here. We need to take another short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. And I have with me Sister Najafi in the studio, who is talking about Islamic upbringing and the responsibilities of parents towards their children in Islam. Sister Najafi, you said very important is marriage. Every person in the society who thinks two people are in need of each other, whatever the move they make towards getting these couple together, they get tremendous rewards in return. Sister Najafi, you were talking about some customs. What are parents doing?
Yeah, I give some rights, definitely, because of our media. Everyone has some imagination, beautiful, like they say, oh, yeah, I want to have this kind of, you know, marriage ceremony for my son or for my daughter.
Yeah.
But we should be very, very practical. Okay, I know your intention is so pure. You know, you want to be very, very, you know, like very nice towards your children. Therefore, you're thinking of, you know, to spend so much money.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to compare the need of your child, you know, that need, the urge. It's not controllable sometimes, you know, they cannot control it because of, again, nowadays, day by day, it's more challenging.
True.
Challenging, yeah? So in one hand, if you are just delaying the marriage ceremony just because of some, you are
to go through some customs and rituals,
yeah,
and to show a trendy marriage.
Yeah. And in other side is maybe my child is committing some sins, you
all
know?
Right.
Yeah. So which one is heavier? You know, which one is more important? That means a lot. So Allah has made me a parent, you know, a trainer, a person who's guiding this beautiful generation. So how come I'm not thinking wisely about my child's future, you know, my child's eternal life? So when I see, oh, maybe, you know, if you have the doubt, the way, like, we travel to a country where we have a doubt, maybe we will not save in that city or country. We don't go, yeah, so maybe I come back safely, but maybe not. So even if you have a doubt, you have to take a precaution, yeah, and you should just skip and just, you know, advice decision for your child's, you know, future. And not only future, not only akhirah, but also here, because, you know, our we can say spiritual need, mental needs is more than our physical need. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I don't need some diamond rings, but I need a good partner.
Really, yeah.
That is more important, the educated one, the nice one, not a one who can give me a nice, you know, like all facilities or whatever we are
something
looking
materialistic
for.
Materialistic.
Yeah,
all right.
Unfortunately.
So that was really a very important point you touched over here. You said that marriage is one of the very important
responsibilities of parents towards their children. And you said not only parents, even if anyone in the society, in a Muslim society, be that your cousins, be that your brothers, be that anyone, be that your friends, teachers, whoever feels that you are in need of someone physically, intellectually, and emotionally, and you have a partner. So whatever the move they make towards getting this couple together, they get tremendous rewards in return, you said. Thank you so much, Sister Najafi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts say COVID-19 has seriously exacerbated problems such as anxiety, depression, and self-harm among school children in England, and that the relentless and unsustainable ongoing rise in their need for help could overwhelm the National Health Service. We are prepared through an article written by Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled Record 420,000 Children a Month in England Treated for Mental Health Problems. In England, more than 400,000 children and young people a month are being treated for mental health problems, the highest number on record, prompting warnings of an unprecedented crisis in the well-being of under-18s. Experts say COVID-19 has seriously exacerbated problems such as anxiety, depression, and self-harm among school-age children, and that the relentless and unsustainable ongoing rise in their need for help could overwhelm the National Health Service. The latest NHS figures show open referrals, troubled children and young people in England undergoing treatment or waiting to start care. reached 420,314 in February, the highest number since records began in 2016. The total has risen by 147,853 since February of 2020, a 54% increase, and by 80,096 over the last year alone, a jump of 24%. January's tally of 411,132 cases was the first time the figure had topped 400,000. Mental health charities welcomed the UK officials' claim that an all-time high number of young people are receiving psychological support. But they fear the figures are the tip of an iceberg of the true number of people who need care, and that many more under-18s in distress are being denied help by arbitrary eligibility criteria. Open referrals are under-18s who are being cared for by child and adolescent mental health services, or are waiting to see a specialist, having been assessed as needing help against treatment thresholds. General practitioners, GPs, teachers and mental health charities believe the criteria are too strict, exclude many who are deemed not ill enough, and amount to rationing of care. Ollie Parker, the head of external affairs at the charity Young Minds, said, "There is an unprecedented crisis in young people's mental health, further evidenced by these record numbers of young people needing help from the National Health Service." Ollie Parker added, "The record high number of children and young people receiving care from the NHS tells us that the crisis in young people's mental health is a wave that's breaking now." He said, "While it was positive that more and more under-18s are receiving psychological support, the rise in the number of young people seeking help from the National Health Service is relentless and unsustainable. Over the past 2 years, young people have experienced isolation, disruption of their education, and reduced access to support, including from counsellors and GPs. All of these things have massively impacted their mental health, but these figures are only the tip of the iceberg and will continue to rise." Ollie Parker said many young people were reaching crisis point before they could get the treatment that they needed. Evidence from the Children's Commissioner for England has shown that while officials claim help from the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services is available within 6 days of being referred in certain areas, in other places families have to wait for as long as 81 days before their child is seen, despite some having self-harmed or had suicidal thoughts. A survey of general practitioners, GPs, published recently by the youth mental health charity STEM4 found that half said the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services were rejecting half of referrals they made of under-18s suffering from anxiety, depression, conduct disorder and self-harm because their symptoms were not seen as severe enough. In one case, a 12-year-old boy found with a ligature in his room was refused help because there was no marks on his neck. Nihara Kraus, a consultant clinical psychologist and founder of youth mental health charity STEM4, said that while under-18s were getting help, it was unclear from the figures how many received effective treatment. Nihara Kraus added, "Teachers and GPs say that children in mental health distress are either being rejected in record numbers because their difficulties do not meet the high threshold for treatment, or they're stuck on long waiting lists. These latest figures also lack any real detail to warrant claiming there has been a marked improvement in accessing effective treatment. They just show greater need." She said not just the prevalence, but also the severity and complexity of youth mental health problems had increased in recent years. In addition, COVID-induced loneliness, increased time spent online, disrupted routines and exposure to family stress have increased levels of distress. Catherine Roche, the chief executive of Place to Be, which provides counselling to 450 primary and secondary schools across the United Kingdom, containing 250,000 pupils, said, "What we've seen across our frontline services in the United Kingdom schools is rising numbers of young people struggling with anxiety, self-harm, eating difficulties and suicidal thoughts." A survey of school heads and other staff by Place to Be and the National Association of Head Teachers, published in February, found that large majorities had seen increases in mental health problems among school pupils since the start of the academic year, including low self-esteem, 86%, depression, 76%, and sustained feelings of anger, 68%. Catherine Roche, the chief executive of charity Place to Be, urged the National Health Service to provide many more early intervention services to support troubled young people as soon as they exhibit signs of distress before their mental health deteriorates. Claire Murdoch, NHS England's National Mental Health Director, said, "The toll of the pandemic has inevitably had an impact on the nation's mental health, with more young people than ever before accessing National Health Service services. As these figures show, demand continues to skyrocket, with a third more children treated in February this year compared to February 2020. Claire Murdoch claimed that the National Health Service had responded by expanding mental health teams in 4,700 schools and colleges and setting up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, mental health crisis telephone support services for all ages, which now receive 20,000 calls a month. The National Health Service data also shows that mental health bed shortages mean some under 16s who are sick enough to be admitted for mental health care are having to be treated on adult mental health wards, despite guidance saying that this should never happen. In February, an unspecified number of under-16s had spent 50 days on adult wards.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.